In today's episode, we're going to talk about how to stop bleeding while on HRT. I'm Dr. Davidson from Progress Your Health.
And I'm Dr. Mackey from Progress Your Health.
So in this episode, we're going to go over a question from another listener. Now, we do a lot of questions from lots of listeners, but this question we get all the time. In fact, I think maybe an episode or two prior to this one, we talked about bleeding while on hormone replacement. Now, typically, if you're on a static dose, which is you're taking the same hormone replacement pretty much every day, you should not be having bleeding, but it is really common.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, even with our patients, this comes up on a regular basis. And every situation is a little bit different, which is why you could have 10 questions, but there's a little nuance to each question, which is the part that has to be pinpointed to figure out what is causing the bleeding to happen so you can basically stop it from happening.
Yes, on static dosing, we don't want to bleed, but I'm going to go ahead and read the question. Yeah. The question is from Amanda. Let's see. Hello, thank you for your informative content. I'm using a 80-20 biased twice a day, taking off Sundays, plus 30 milligrams of transdermal progesterone for the last 6 months and doing pretty well. My numbers look good, no breast tenderness, muscles feel better, bladder is stronger, etc. However, I am having light bleeding every few days, every 3 weeks. I'm not yet menopausal, but close, as before the hormones, I did go 5 months without a period. I want to avoid any hyperplasia, and I am slightly concerned. However, I don't think I can lower my dose of biased estrogen without negative side effects. Any advice would be helpful. I am 57 years old. Thank you.
I didn't catch it the first time. You know, you and I sort of prepped this a little bit ahead of time before we turned the camera on. But this is what happens all the time when women write us questions. I don't know. This is must have happened by this point dozens, if not hundreds of times. She puts the ratio in there, but does not put the dosage of her biased in there. 80-20, but no milligram. How many milligrams? The 80-20 really, you know, you would agree the 80-20 doesn't really matter that much. It's the milligrams of the prescription that actually matters.
Because it's hard when you get your hormone cream to even understand googly glop, you know, stuff written on there. It's hard to read it. So an 80-20, so biased is a combination of estriol E3 and estradiol E2. And they call that, if you do an 80-20 ratio, that means there's on your prescription or your hormone cream of biased, there's 80% estriol and 20% estradiol. Now you can do any ratio you want where you're doing hormone replacement for a biased, but when you have a certain dose and someone gets it, it'll say like E2 0.02 with the E3.08, you know, you can have all these different zeros and numbers, and it's really hard to put that together. Like, for example, let's say 10 milligrams of biased. So 80%, 8 milligrams would be estriol, E3, and then 2 milligrams would be estradiol, E2. So that has an 80-20 ratio for 10 milligrams of biased. But when the pharmacies, which they have to write it very specifically. So that's why they don't put the dose
well,
in
now,
there.
No one, very few people that we send us questions are getting 10 milligrams of biased.
No, I was just trying to do the math.
One milligram would be 0.8 estriol and 0.2 of estradiol. That's usually more typical of what we get.
I was just saying that the 10 milligrams, because math can be difficult. So it's easy to say, you know, take a 10, 80% is 8 milligrams, is, 20% is 2, to help somebody understand, you know, what an 80-20 ratio is.
I'm looking at the prescription labels. It really is it's like a foreign language. Like, you really don't know how to make any sense of it. But in these situations, the ratio does not matter. Okay? The ratio really does not matter too much. Now, if it's 50-50 or, 90-10, 80-20, it does make a difference. But the milligrams, how many milligrams, like you just, we're going to do one just on how to read the prescription label. We're going to actually have like some kind of a slide that comes in and shows the math. So when you look at your own prescriptions, you can actually kind of decipher what it says, because I think that would be valuable. And just to note, when you do write us a question, for anyone listening and you're interested and you have a concern, the milligrams are more important than the ratio. So even if it is broken down, like you said, a half and half, so 80% of this and the numbers, and there's decimals, and it gets really complicated.
So if you're not sure and you're writing a question, just write down everything you see on your prescription, every, you know, decimal point, zero, special character, number, anything, and I can figure it out. Because I've had patients that have come to see me from other doctors, or they're getting a prescription somewhere else, and I'm just like, take a picture of it or read me everything on it. I'll be able to figure it out. Because it is, like you said, it is like a foreign language.
Absolutely. And the pharmacy has their language because that's what they are required to do. No problem. The label, every prescription has to have a very specific label on there of what's in it. You know, if it's not a branded medication, like, you know, something that you get at a big box pharmacy, it's easy. All they have to do is just put the name of that prescription on there. So it's very simple. But in this context, it has to be broken down because you're using two separate hormones and then the numbers. And if you add testosterone to it and DHEA and progesterone, then you have this big, long, you know, string of words, words and numbers that really, you know, most people don't really know how to understand. So just in general, in this context, because we're talking about bleeding, the dose determines the bleeding. The ratio doesn't necessarily determine the bleeding.
Exactly. I mean, I like to know the ratio, but it doesn't matter the ratio if you can write all of the different letters, special characters, decimal points, anything. We'll figure it out. Because for Amanda here, she should not be having any bleeding whatsoever being on her hormones. No, she's 57 years old. And this was the part that why everybody is so different and why I wanted to talk about this. And we were kind of deciding what we would kind of focus on this is she says she's not quite menopausal, but she's 57 years old. Yeah. Yes, we do have women that cycle up to 55. Okay. But she says she's, so this is where I think sometimes the theory kind of messes with reality, because there is a theory out there that says if you have not had a period in 12 months, then you are menopausal. You are postmenopausal. But if you don't have a period for 5 months and then you have one, oh, I guess you're not menopausal. Yeah. But she's 57 years old. Now, if she was 47 years old, that'd be a different story. So I feel like for Amanda, maybe her practitioners might be minimizing the situation because they don't consider her menopausal when she truly is.
Yeah, yeah. At 57, she's in menopause for sure. Yeah. Now, I've had, I think the and she just actually transitioned fairly recently. I think she ended up stopping her period at 56. I think that's a patient.
Oh, a patient, a previous patient. Gotcha.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that's probably the latest that I've seen. I've seen a few, 53, 54, 55. I think 56 was probably the latest. Mm-hmm. You know, but at 57, you know, it'd be interesting to see what her FSH level is. I'm sure her FSH level is pretty darn high.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. So that's where instead of saying, oh, you have to wait 12 months of not having a period before you're menopausal, you can do blood work and you do a follicle stimulating hormone, which is a signal from the brain that monitors your overall ovarian status. The higher that FSH, the lower your ovarian function is. So if somebody has an FSH at 100, 120, 130, 95, that's pretty high. If someone has it around 2.5, then they're menstruating. We know that they're menstruating, they're fertile. But when you see that higher FSH, I guarantee you Amanda has a higher FSH regardless of missing her period for 5 months or having had one. So that's where, like I said, don't go by the idea that I had a period, you know, 8 months ago, so I must not be menopausal. So if you are on hormones and you're bleeding, thinking, well, I'm technically in perimenopause, you're not. Yeah. You're not, that's not, and I don't want to get like
a 57-year-old in perimenopause. That's, you know, not really, it's sort of a, I mean, for you and I, just because we're dealing with these things a lot, it sort of sounds like a little chuckle, you know, being in perimenopause and you're almost 60, you know, not quite so much. But I think you're right. I think that, you know, the presence of a period now, if she hasn't had one for 5 months, what do you think that the previous one before that was? Probably another 5 months before that or 6 months before that?
You know, who knows? Maybe 3 months. I mean, everybody is different. Obviously, she went on hormones because she talked about having these symptoms, right? So I feel like for Amanda, and I, you know, I don't want to beat a dead horse here. It, you know, having some bleeding while you're on HRT and trying to finesse it, it does happen. It doesn't mean that you have cancer. It doesn't mean that it's super dangerous. It just means we need to readjust the dose. But you don't want to continue having bleeding for long periods of time because then that's not safe.
Well, now, because she had a period 5 months ago and then you start HRT shortly thereafter, the proximity of the period, the last period and the start of the HRT, it sort of makes you a little bit more prone to bleeding. It almost like it, you know, kind of resurrects that ovarian function and that endometrial lining is a little bit more sensitive to the presence of estrogen. So in the beginning, when you start HRT, the likelihood of bleeding goes up pretty high. It, you know, it's much more common in the early stages as opposed to if you haven't had a period for a couple of years.
Yeah, exactly. So when you just like for me, let's see, what is right now? It's January. So I had a, you know, I'm going through menopause right now. I'm on hormones. I had last year, I think it was like last March, I had a period, and then I didn't have one for a few months, and then it was like July, and then there was nothing till, you know, a little bit. And then I, of course, I've been a kind of off and on hormones, different hormones, because I experiment with everything, but I've been on hormones now, and now I am getting a period, but that's the way I'm doing my hormones. Is you can do, as we've talked about before with rhythmic dosing, is you can dose the hormones in a way that you basically mimic the natural cycle so that you do get a period. So me getting a period every month being on HRT is important because of the way that I'm doing it. The way that Amanda's doing it, she's doing a static dose every day except the Sunday thing, which we'll get into a little bit later, is she should not be having a period and things need to be readjusted, especially what do you think really specifically needs to be adjusted.
There's two things. We need to know what her bias dose is. That's one thing. But really the kicker, which is why this is important. So this is about two things. It's about estrogen causing the bleeding. But really, in the question, it says that she's on 30 milligrams of transdermal progesterone. Now, we did another episode. I'm not exactly sure how many ago it was. And we did another episode talking about specifically this. We typically like to use capsule progesterone, oral progesterone, to prevent the growth of the uterine lining. We're not real big fans of using transdermal progesterone, certainly 30 milligrams, because she's bleeding every 3 weeks. 30 milligrams for her as an individual is just not enough.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been doing this since 2003, 2004, doing hormone replacement. The literature, I mean, granted, there's not a lot of studies on the bioidentical hormones because there just really isn't a lot of probably profit for it. But the synthetic hormones, there's lots of, literature on that, trying to keep that lining of the uterus. I think you've even done a lot of research looking at different, progestins and whatnot for protecting the uterine lining that had been, back in the 90s and 2000s, is we do know that oral progesterone will protect the uterine lining from getting too thick. That we do know that, whether it's a progestin, which is really gross, don't ever take that, but doing a micronized oral bioidentical progesterone, doing a good dose of that will protect the uterine lining. Mm-hmm. We don't know that about transdermal creams. Now, there's a lot of anecdotal information out there. There's some pharmacists that we love that we could sit down and talk for hours about how they believe the transdermal is going to protect the uterus. And I'm like, well, I'm not sure, so sure. Give me some more information. Have a great talk about that. Still, the transdermal is just not quite as strong. Now, when you do, that's Bob. That's our dog. I think he's sleeping and having a little
dream. He's having a little dream down there.
So cute. The dogs are so cute. So in any case, I feel like the transdermal may not be the right idea for Amanda because she did stop menstruating not too long ago. And then the dosage, right? Wouldn't you agree the dosage, 30 milligrams?
30 milligrams. Clearly, this is the key, right? So every woman's dose is her specific dose. What works for one doesn't work for the next. So whatever her bias dose is, and my guess is just from doing this for a while and people sending us questions, that her dose is less than 3 milligrams, probably less than 2 milligrams. So if she's bleeding every 3 weeks, that means the progesterone is not nearly high enough. Now, on a transdermal, that needs to be probably, you need to sort of overcompensate. I think it needs to be closer to 200 milligrams. But really, she does not want to lower her bias dose, no matter what it is. We don't know what that dose is. She even says she doesn't want to lower it because she feels good on that amount. That means her progesterone needs to be switched to an oral capsule.
Yeah, I would agree. I wouldn't say, Amanda, we would lower the estrogen. Estrogen's awesome. I think she should keep the estrogen, the bias, the same. And I like that she's taking it to our BID twice a day, but the progesterone needs to go up. Honestly, I would switch her to the oral. I do get menopausal women, doing the oral progesterone is so nice because oral progesterone does cross that blood-brain barrier to increase up your GABA. So that helps with sleep. That helps
reduces
with mood.
Anxiety.
Yeah, reduces anxiety, which is a hallmark of menopause, especially with women that have had a history of anxiety and depression prior to menopause. There is studies that show that women that have had a prior history of depression and anxiety prior to menopause, it gets so much worse after menopause. So doing an oral progesterone where you don't really see that effect with GABA when you're doing the transdermal progesterone. So I would say switching her to that, and just for dosage facts, 100 milligrams is, I don't ever go lower than 100 milligrams for that uterus. I mean, there are some exceptions, but 100 milligrams is like a size medium. So 100 milligrams of an oral progesterone would be really nice for Amanda. And honestly, I would just have her take it every day. I mean, the Sunday off, I'm not really sure. I know that there's some theories about, this was actually, I like 12 years ago, I went probably even longer than that, that some doctors would talk about taking a hormone holiday or a little hormone vacation to kind of something about the liver metabolites.
And the receptors, you know, estrogen, progesterone receptors.
But I just find that if somebody takes their hormones off one day, they just feel kind of crummy for that one day.
Well, I think that and this is not to criticize other practitioners too, but I think that they think that there is some safety benefit by stopping like that, which, you know, you could, you know, certainly argue that point for sure. But in this case, she's already not safe because she's already bleeding. Now, granted, in the short term, the first little bit, you know, her bleeding like that, the fact that it is still consistent, right, every 3 weeks, it's like she's having a period. Okay, now, it says light bleeding. So, you know, I think that's ultimately a good thing because her body is telling her and their practitioner something that now needs to be adjusted. Now, usually the two things that happen, like you said, is either the estrogen dose goes down or the progesterone dose goes up. She doesn't want to lower the estrogen dose. Most women don't because they feel good. Now, you mentioned something a second ago. Now, here's, you know, devil's advocate. What if you go up to 100 milligrams of the progesterone standard and she's still bleeding? What do you do then?
Then you can actually increase up that progesterone. I mean, you can increase some. I have some women on, like I said, a 100 is, I wouldn't say it's like a size medium. It's like the first dose. That's the most common dose, but I would say most of my patients are like on 150 milligrams. Like that's probably more of a common dose. I have a few on 200 milligrams of oral progesterone.
I think I have more on 200 than you do.
Yeah, I think you do too.
I think I have, because I usually start them at 100, and then if they're still having sleep trouble or anxiety or anything like that, I say just take two. Take two and double it and then see how you feel. If you don't feel very good, then go back to one. And then some just like it and they just stay there. Now I don't mind going that direction because there's more uterine protection that way, which, you know, in some ways up to the 200, in some ways more progesterone, the better. Okay. Now again, second, pushback on that. What if you go up to 200 and she's still bleeding then? What do you do?
Of course you want to do a transvaginal ultrasound because we want to find out, is the lining thick? Because if you have a thick lining, you're kind of having that slough off, that can cause bleeding. Polyps can cause bleeding. Fibroids can get activated and can cause bleeding. So I had a patient recently, two patients. One, she was doing some sporadic bleeding. I couldn't figure out why. And we did the transvaginal ultrasound.
When you say sporadic, like how sporadic? Like every 3 weeks like this or more sporadic than that?
Well, let's say you're working with somebody and they're getting a little bleeding. I'll usually say, you know what, stop your estrogen, just stay on your progesterone and let's see what happens. And if it stops, then we know that there's something going on with the estrogen that's causing it.
Right.
So this one patient, we'd stop the estrogen, it might happen, and then she might I have her restart it and then it happens. So and you don't want to do that for too long because you want to figure out what's the culprit here. Is we did a transvaginal ultrasound and she has the Nabothian cysts on her cervix. So little cysts there can get irritated and cause bleeding. That's actually pretty common. And then I had just another patient and she's actually in her 70s, early 70s. And she's got Nabothian cyst, but she's got a different cyst that's just on the cervix. It's not that Cooper's gland, but it's a different cyst and it's just there and it's kind of irritated. Not anything that her gynecologist felt like removing, but that was the culprit. It wasn't the hormones irritating it. She has this little cyst.
And how did you determine that it wasn't the hormones?
Oh, we did a transvaginal ultrasound.
So the lining wasn't thickened? Mm-mm. Oh, okay.
No,
so
not at all.
So if the lining wasn't, so the rationale there is the lining wasn't thickened. The bleeding wasn't coming from the lining. It was coming from the cyst instead.
Yeah. So the other patient, I think they removed the cyst. Okay. So it's finding out where it's coming from. A lot of women get, you know, cervical cysts, easily when they're in their 30s, 20s, that's pretty common to have kind of irregular bleeding from that. Polyps are really common. I've had polyps before. They're just one of those things. And that can cause some irregular bleeding that you're not really sure where that's coming from. So if she's still bleeding, then you absolutely do a transvaginal ultrasound and find out. Now, some women their uterus is just really sensitive to estrogen, just super sensitive. I had women where their breast tissue is super sensitive to estrogen. Yeah, so that's where
they get full, they hurt, they grow cup size. I've had a few of those too.
And you can't
predict those. You don't know who they're going to be.
Nope, everybody's different. But that's where the ratio is important. So you might switch that 80-20. So instead of, because it's usually the estradiol. Estriol isn't causing the breast tenderness or the uterine. Estriol doesn't cause uterine thickening. So it's usually that estradiol. So then you can change that ratio to maybe 10% of the estradiol and 90% of the estriol, you know, depending on what dose you're doing, just changing the ratio. So I would say for Amanda, which I'm sure she probably will end up having, is probably getting a transvaginal ultrasound, see how thick that is. But I guarantee, I don't want to say guarantee because everybody, you never know, but I feel like that transdermal progesterone, that's probably the culprit.
Yeah. That's why this is a good question. Short, sweet, simple. The progesterone for in the short term just needs to go up. Now I like your idea. Now, would you, and right now, because she's having the bleeding every 3 weeks, would you do a transvaginal ultrasound now, or would you just raise the progesterone first, the bleeding goes away, and then there's no need to do the transvaginal ultrasound, or would you do both right now?
Probably right now. I mean, it's always nice to have a transvaginal ultrasound every once in a while anyway.
Sure,
all patients should have one if they have a uterus.
If you're doing hormones, you can't go wrong doing a transvaginal ultrasound. I know some clinics, some doctors require it every year to do it.
I completely agree with that, but it's, and they're completely non-invasive. I mean, it's not painful like a uterine biopsy when you're awake. That's like the worst, but it's, transvaginal ultrasound is super easy. So easily you could do that, but I would, definitely change that progesterone and raise that up. And then, at some point, probably even later, just do a transvaginal ultrasound just to check.
Yeah, sure. Well, if there's no more bleeding, you can sort of assume, cause that's what you don't want with hormone replacement, is you don't want this low grade, endometrial growth, with no warning sign. That's where it gets, so you're on hormones for, 3, 5, 6, 7 years, maybe even a little longer. You start them in your early 50s. Now you're in your early 60s. And that's when you start getting some bleeding. That's a little bit more, a little bit more of some urgency there. Mm-hmm. If you just randomly start having early stage of HRT, no big deal. Mm-hmm. The first 6 months, maybe even the first year, you're going to expect something like that. The longer you're on it and then you have bleeding and there's been no dose change, that'll get your attention real quick. Now the worst case scenario, if you're not on any hormones and you're having bleeding and you're in your, mid to late 50s, early 60s, and you're bleeding with no hormones, you need a transvaginal ultrasound immediately.
Yeah.
Right. That's not, I don't know how common that is. I mean, have you ever seen that before?
Yeah. With actual women that have uterine cancer that maybe haven't been on hormones and then they start bleeding. I have seen that. Actually, one patient, this must have been like maybe 2010, she postmenopausal. I wasn't treating her for that kind, for menopause.
Was she just on like thyroid or something?
Yeah, I think we were just doing some botanical medicine. Oh, okay. It was just really fun.
And how old was she?
She was 65. I mean, brilliant, super smart. She was also a practitioner, and she started bleeding, but she was doing something she had bought like through the mail online that was supposed to help like detoxer. So when she was having that, the person she was talking to, that or whoever she was buying it from, said that it was part of her like fibroids detoxing out of her body,
which you can't do.
No, I'm like, that's not a fibroid.
The bleeding was
it could be a fibroid,
her discharging the fibroids.
The bleeding. Whoa. The vaginal bleeding. I'm like, no. I mean, it could be a fibroid because fibroids do cause bleeding, but you hadn't bled for many years.
A 65-year-old is not going to be bleeding from a fibroid.
A pap smear and the cells came back malignant, and then I sent her over to a colleague of mine, and he removed her ovaries and her uterus at 65, and she was great.
Yeah.
It was uterine cancer, but it hadn't moved. It was great. Any bleeding.
So like early stage, like it didn't get outside the uterus. There's no metastasis, nothing like that.
Took it all out and she was good to go, but it was.
That was lucky. Lucky on her part.
Super lucky on that. So I'm glad that we were able to take care of that. So I know for Amanda, I don't want to freak her out because she's just newly into menopause.
Yeah.
She is menopausal, but she's newly into menopause.
Right.
It's just really tweaking up those hormones to not bleed because kind of annoying to bleed all the time.
Well, honestly, I'm sure it is, but mm-hmm. That's why we talk about these bleeding ones all the time, because everyone's there's a little reason into each single question as to why. Now, usually it's the estrogen dose is too high, the patch, notorious, going to cause some bleeding, or the progesterone dose is not high enough. Either the form or the type is not high enough. So that's why each little one, if there's, you're listening out there that can relate to some of the things we say, your prescriptions might be the similar, similar ones. And if you're having some of those issues, now it gives you a little bit more, information, a little bit more awareness to what to do about it. So
just on a quick side note. I loved that she wrote a couple of the symptoms. Like she said, she doesn't have any breast tenderness. Mm-hmm. So that makes us think that her estrogen is pretty good. Because if someone has too much estrogen, the breasts do get right. tender, like you were saying. And then
that's me telling you that. Of course you know that. I mean, it's one of those feedback things, right? You just hear women complain about something. And it's usually when the dose goes up a little bit too much, that's going to be usually one of those first things that they report back.
And then she also mentioned that her muscles feel better. What do you think that's about?
Well, you know, I know that on social media, you know, on Instagram and, you know, even YouTube here, you know, everything else, there's a lot of talk about these secondary symptoms related to menopause these days that some of the other menopausal experts are talking about, you know, like frozen shoulder and, you know, probably some of the osteoarthritis type things related to the drop in estrogen. The muscle piece, I didn't really pick up on that. I would love to know what your thoughts are.
I think I'm finally, that's what I say, finally, people are talking about that menopause is not just hot flashes and night sweats and maybe getting a little moody, you know, or gaining weight. That was always the thing. Weight gain, hot flashes, night sweats, moody, maybe some hair loss. Like they're finally talking about really how menopause affects the entire system. And
even your personality.
Exactly.
Everything. Like your mood, your physical body, your emotion, everything, like literally. And that's what I'm saying. Like social media is really trying to expand the scope that it's not just you're not just having hot flash and you're a little bitchy these days. It's actually a lot more than that.
Yeah, no, finally.
I think that's kind of like a male, not to get, political about it, but I think it's like a male way, I'm criticizing, male doctors and practitioners and just to sort of blow it off that it's really not that big of a deal, right? But, honestly, we've seen it, the effect that hormones can have on a woman and how it can sort of kind of resurrect them a little bit, right? They really come out of their, out of the funk that they've been in for a while. Once you see that a few times, you sort of know that whatever we're doing is actually having a nice impact and it's benefiting them significantly. Mm-hmm. There's a few cases. I remember way back when, I was going to California all the time, and this woman, she was a handful. When I first saw her, she was mad and angry and pissy and she was just a hornet's nest. And I put on hormones and I saw her back, I don't know, a month, maybe 2 months. And she was smiling and she was a completely different woman. And I told her, let's just call her, let's call her Leslie. That wasn't her name, but just in case she ends up listening to this or something, she would know. But
we love you, Leslie.
But she was, that was like my first, and this was probably, almost 12, 13, 14 years ago. It was the first opportunity, because you've been doing hormones even way before I did. I've learned all my hormone things from you, which is why we're doing the podcast, because you're like, I consider you like the hormonal master, but that was like the first glimpse, maybe not the first one, but one of the first things that I can remember where you could see this complete personality change in just a very short amount of time. She was just mad at the world. And then she came back and she's just like smiling and, and now granted, it didn't last very long. I think she gained her anger back a little bit. She had a lot going on in her personal life, a lot of stressors, that I think that sort of, that contributed to some of that, anger and frustration. But honestly, that was, that was pretty, pretty profound because she was like two different people. It was pretty wild.
No, I love
it. And I know you've seen that many, many times. I know you've seen that, hundreds, if not thousands of times at this point.
Oh yeah. I've had couples come in together because, they want to work on their relationship. Menopause is tough. And just like, Amanda's talking about the muscles. So kind of back to that is I do feel like estrogen helps reduce inflammation.
Okay. So just a simple inflammation.
Straight up reduces inflammation.
Oh, that we do know, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, all inflammation. If you think about, diabetes, heart disease, Alzheimer's and cancer, those, the big, the four horsemen, as Dr. Atiyah calls them, those are all inflammatory diseases, right? So, anything we can do to reduce that level of inflammation, that's why the risk of all those for a woman is going to increase at 55. Mm-hmm. Men, it's a little bit different for men, women have that have that sort of safety net of estrogen until they get into menopause. And I heard another little thing on social media too, and I need to look into this research, but someone was talking about hormone replacement actually increases longevity for like 3.5 years or something
like
that.
They have an actual number on it.
Yeah. And I don't remember where I heard it. It was on some other health podcast, or I just saw a little clip of it. And I'm like, oh, I got to find that study and figure out what that is. Because you and I, as I just sort of explained, you and I inherently sort of know that, right? Because we've seen these before and afters of people just through observation. But actually having real numbers behind that, I think is actually really nice. It gives some validation that these are not just hocus pocus potions for women. They're actually doing something real. You know, not only are they making women feel better, but they're actually, you know, in some ways either preventing disease and or increasing longevity. I think all those things are very good.
What do you think about her, Amanda also mentioning that her hormones have helped her bladder get stronger?
Well, I would expect that to be from a vaginal application, right? So there'd be a little bit more proximity. I don't know. I mean, I would be a little surprised, again, depending on what her dose is, for that to have an impact. But, you know, like you said, a little bit of estrogen for a menopausal woman goes a very long way. So, that doesn't mean that more is better, because in her context, the way she's dosing it, you have an upper limit as to how much you can dose. But I think it's great. I think it's really, really, really amazing on all those different areas that she's having benefit.
Yeah, no, I've seen, and you have too, you know, doing estrogen therapy does help the bladder. And as females, I'll be the first one to say, we drink water, we have to go to the bathroom. I mean, I plan, if I'm going to go on a plane, don't drink any water, because I don't want to use the bathroom there. If we're going on a road trip, okay, let's plan this.
Oh, geez.
Maybe I go to the bathroom a little bit more than others. Yes. So, but I get up in the middle
of
the night.
You go like 3 to 4 times for my every one.
But that's me. And when you, and I've always been a little bit that way too. Even when I was in my 20s, that was just my thing. My friends even would laugh at me about that.
But even your other girlfriends?
Yeah, yeah. They were
really
so funny. Yeah,
okay. They didn't do the same thing? Yeah.
Don't you remember how I met you in college?
Yeah.
There was a line we were at some after event.
So we've been in school for a couple of years. We are taking our mid-program board exam. So you have 2 years of basic sciences, and then you have to pass the basic science board exams to go on to the clinical part of medical school. We went to Astor University in Seattle. So we just finished University of Washington, your alma mater. We just finished taking our board exam. So of course we went to a bar to celebrate afterwards. Just not, you and I didn't go together. Mm-hmm. We hadn't met anybody there yet.
100 people or 50 people. There's so many people there.
So the school that we went to was predominantly probably 3/4 plus women. There's a lot of women and not as many men. So of course I go, you know, as I would, I go into the male's bathroom to go to the bathroom, and your friend, was it Bridget?
Yeah, my friend Bridget, because they all knew I had to go to the bathroom. You know, at concerts, at movie theaters,
sure.
You go to the, well, you go see, look at the bathrooms.
Well, guys don't understand that stuff. They just don't understand that stuff.
Even if you go to a concert or after a baseball game or something, you look at the men's bathroom and the female bathroom, there's always a line.
Yeah, that's true.
There's always a line in the women's bathroom. Yeah. Same with the airport.
You're right.
There's always a line in the women's bathroom. So there's this line. So Bridget was so sweet. She peeked in the men's bathroom and asked you if I could use it.
Yeah. I'm using the urinal. I'm peeing in the urinal, and then you go into the stall to go in the bathroom. And I heard you pee.
It was love at first pee.
I heard you tinkle. We didn't actually. So that would have been 99, 2000. We did
One,
not.
2001.
That would have been 2000. Okay, so 2 years, 99, 2000. We did not actually start dating in 2000 until 2001. So it was a whole another year until you and I started dating.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's how we met. But what I was saying is estrogen does help tonify that urethra and that bladder so you can hold it a little longer. I was talking to a patient yesterday and we were like, yeah, you know when you have to go to the bathroom? When you get older, you know you have to know, you have to go. When you got to go, you better go, rather than being able to hold it for a while. But that's what estrogen does.
You're on hormones now, so have you noticed any difference?
You know,
I haven't.
No. I drink a lot of water. I'm the same as I was, like I said, when I was in my 20s and I met you.
Yeah. Oh, that's fine. But I mean, I'm not complaining.
It does help that urethra and the bladder. So
you probably drink a little too much at night, though.
Oh, I know. I know I do. Yeah. But I like it. It tastes good. I like to drink water.
Okay. All right. Do we have anything else to say about Amanda? I think Amanda's is a good one to learn from, and it comes up all the time. So hopefully there's been some value or some learning from this one. Amanda, if you're watching or listening, hopefully that you've learned something from it as well, and you get that bleeding corrected fairly quickly. Anything else to add?
No. Thank you. We change everybody's names, but I'm sure that Amanda knows that we're talking about Amanda.
Yeah. So until next time, I'm Dr. Mackey.
I'm Dr. Davidson.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.